So I'm Aaron Sinreich. I'm a professor in Steinhardt, Media, Culture, and Communication. I met our guest speaker about 5 years ago when he was co-organizing the Ready to Share conference, looking at the fashion industry and the commons at USC, where I was doing my doctorate back in, what was that, 2003, 2004?
No, 2003,
a long time ago. And in all those years, even back then, David was already a very established person in this field. And as those of you who follow Copy Fight know, that was really kind of the beginning back then. In all these years, he has been a singularly tireless champion of the commons and of the rights of everyday people like you and me to participate fully in the production, dissemination, and full enjoyment of culture and other social forms. David has written a number of books. I don't know what that number is, but it's higher than the number of books that I've written, which is one. His latest book, Viral Spiral, is what he's going to be presenting today. I routinely assign his earlier book, Brand Name Bullies, for the students in my intellectual property and copyright class in my department. Take it if you haven't, and you're in my department. He has also was the co-founder of Public Knowledge, which is one of the premier advocacy groups for participatory culture and legal reform in the United States right now. He is the chief blogger at onthecommons.org. I don't know exactly what his title is there either. And he is a senior fellow at the Norman Lear Center, which is a USC-affiliated media and technology research think tank based in Los Angeles. So this is a man who wears many hats. All of them are very fancy, very special, and he's like Bartholomew Cubbins of the IP set. He's fantastic. I guess you guys are a little young for that. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to this talk, and David is really looking forward to giving it, and he's going to have plenty of time for your questions and comments afterwards. So please don't be shy. As soon as he's done, raise your hand and throw him the hardest hardball or curviest curveball you can, because he's heard it all and seen it all, and he'll throw it right back at you. And I'd also like to say many thanks to Evan Korth of Computer Science for co-organizing and sponsoring this event with me. This is a great room, and he's done some amazing guest lectures by other people for his Computers in Society class, which I also recommend you take when he next offers it. So without further ado, take it away, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I came to write this book because I live in the zone between politics, journalism, and academia, and I also had been traveling in the as a non-techie participant journalist in the free culture, open source world. And I realized that there was a whole folk culture and history that wasn't written down, and that a lot of people were coming into this world in half a generation later, and some of the history was not really known, and I myself didn't know some of the history and wanted to know more about it. So my purpose was to show the arc of the historical development of what is broadly described as free culture, and show its origins, that it wasn't a natural occurrence that was just happened to be there, but it was really a long struggle, and that it had some deep political implications both then and now into the future. And I will start by reading just an excerpt from the introduction of my book, which I think lays the groundwork of the territory I wanted to cover. Two profoundly incommensurate media systems are locked in a struggle for survival or supremacy, depending upon your perspective, or perhaps mutual accommodation. For the moment, we live in a confusing interregnum, a transition that pits the dwindling power and often desperate strategies of centralized media against the callow, experimental vigor of internet-based media. This much is clear, however: a world organized around centralized control, strict intellectual property rights, and hierarchies of credentialed expertise is under siege. A radically different order of society based on open access, decentralized creativity, collaborative intelligence, and cheap and easy sharing is ascendant. Or to put it more precisely, we're stumbling into a strange hybrid order that combines both worlds, mass media and online networks, on terms that have yet to be negotiated. But who shall do the negotiating? Who will set forth a compelling alternative to centralized media and build it? That task has fallen to a loosely coordinated global federation of digital tribes, the free software and open source hackers, the Wikipedians, the bloggers and citizen journalists, the remix musicians and filmmakers, the avant-garde artists and political dissidents, the educators and scientists, and many others. It's a spontaneous folk tech conspiracy that belongs to everyone and no one. So that is sort of the rough scenario that I wanted to explore, and how did it emerge? Some of you may be wondering, what exactly is a commoner, as I describe here? Well, let's start by saying that a commoner is not a consumer who's oriented towards buying and selling or oriented towards the market. And commoners aren't citizens either in a strict sense, in that they're not specifically oriented towards government and public policy the way traditional citizen activists are. The commoners are really about something different. They're about participating in communities based on shared ideals, shared resources, and building it out. So on the internet, this generally consists of such things as pools of music and video and text, amateurs contributing what they want according to their passions, and then sharing it with each other. And we all know these things, especially people under 35. It's part of their social milieu. But a commons is more than a rhetorical term or a buzzword. It's really a new paradigm, and it describes what happens when a community decides that it wants to manage a resource in a shared manner with a special regard for equitable access, use, and sustainability over time. So what distinguishes the digital republic from the image that people have of bloggers in their pajamas or teenagers sharing nutty videos on YouTube is that the commons has a sovereignty. People control their own digital environment. And essentially, they've created their own free software platforms, their own legal licenses to control their content, and they've created their own social ethic for managing it and governing themselves. And so this creates the rudiments of a new polity, one might say, a new digital republic. I call it the common sector. These are some of the more prominent ones out there. You'll probably recognize the logo for the free software, the Wikipedia. Gemendo's a music sharing site Belgium, I think. The Internet Archives, huge repository, Flickr, the photo sharing site, and really there's countless others out there. But we really don't have a taxonomy for understanding this emerging world. Let me also start by explaining the title of my book, Viral Spiral. Viral, for anybody who's around the internet, knows that it's the almost mysterious way that things diffuse in internet in networks. And spiral refers to the way that the innovation of one cohort of digital participants becomes the platform for another and another, so that you have this upward spiral of innovation building upon the earlier ones, all of which remains part of the common sector and can't be taken private or appropriated. The story really starts with copyright law. And for those of you who may have studied it, copyright law is not really a naturally occurring thing. It's a civic invention. And it's it has utilitarian purposes to help elicit new knowledge and innovation. And it does this by conferring a limited private property right on creators, which allows them to put an envelope of property rights around their work and sell it in the marketplace. And this is the thinking goes that this will help them earn a livelihood and elicit new creativity and diffuse that knowledge. And all of that is true up to a point. But the implication historically has been that if it doesn't have property rights, it's worthless. And the story of the viral spiral, as I tell it, really begins when it was discovered that the public domain had some value. Traditionally, this is how copyright scholars and lawyers tend to regard the public domain, as this dusty attic filled with junk. You've got old government documents and sheet music from the 20s and stuff that nobody really reads, and it's really worthless. And The legal scholars have described it as the dark star in the constellation of intellectual property, or the opposite of property. And in fact, the first law review article on the public domain wasn't until 1981, and the second not until 1990. So essentially, it's been regarded as not really something you need to spend your time with. It's worthless. But if Galileo discovered that the planets moved, and Isaac Newton that an object in motion tends to stay in motion, Richard Stallman was arguably the person who first discovered that the public domain had demonstrable value. He, of course, is the legendary hacker from MIT who took great pains to develop free software. And he distinguishes free. By free, he doesn't mean at no cost, of course. He means free as in freedom, as he will constantly say. You've probably heard free as in free, not as in free beer, the famous saying. Stallman was disturbed in the 1980s that the hacker community was disintegrating as more programmers went off to build proprietary software. And he developed a singular innovation, the general public license, as a way of retaining the code that hackers had created so that it would remain part of a commons. As many of you know, it's often called copyleft. And essentially it means that you can use this code, it's based on copyright, and it's a prerogative that the copyright holder expresses, saying you can use this work and share it and use it for whatever purpose you want. You can make derivative works, you just have to release it under the same license so that no one else can take it private. And this was a remarkable legal innovation because it created the viral capacities of something to continue to grow in a free capacity without anyone being able to appropriate it. Interestingly, you could commercialize it so long as you didn't take it private. And that proved to be a very important feature for the growth of free software as companies like IBM saw strategic competitive value in using GPL software, especially Linux. Now, Stallman might have languished in obscurity, but for two things. One was the rise of the Internet in the 1990s, especially 1994 when the web went big, and the proprietarian revolution in the 1990s as copyright industries, the record industry, the film industry, the publishers, information companies, started asserting broader and broader intellectual property rights over works. One of the more significant ones was the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which was promoted largely by the Disney company because Mickey Mouse was due to enter the public domain in 2003, and they didn't want Mickey to become widely available like that. So they prevailed upon Sonny Bono, a congressman from California, to introduce a law to retroactively extend the term of copyright to works that already existed. It was frankly just a giveaway worth billions of dollars to industries with huge inventories. And as Larry Lessig pointed out, if the purpose of copyright is to incentivize authors to create new works, why are you trying to incentivize mostly dead authors who are not going to be creating any more Robert Frost poetry or George Gershwin music and so forth? Nonetheless, it passed, and that was a major proprietarian expansion in the 1990s. One way I like to illustrate it is I need the incentive to write this speech, or my remarks here. I need the incentive of my lifetime plus another 70 years to create that. That's how that's the philosophy behind the copyright law right now. And it's just far more than is really needed. I'll just skip through some of these without going through it in any great depth because the story is, in fact, a broader and far more complex story. But these are some of the major things that occurred in the 1990s to expand the rights of copyright holders. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998 gave copyright holders the unilateral right to lock up digital content and prevent fair use in that content. And so such things as reverse engineering were often difficult, if not illegal, under the DMCA. trademark dilution and tarnishment, new doctrines established by trademark holders, which essentially allows them to control the public meaning of their work. So if Walmart didn't like the way you were using a happy face that looked like its, even though it took the happy face from the commons in the first place, it could say that you were diluting and tarnishing its trademark. And there are many examples of that that have occurred. Shrinkage and fair use rights. The Nation magazine once used a 300-word excerpt from Gerald Ford's memoirs, which it got a scoop before the book was published. Supreme Court declared that that was not a fair use, despite Gerald Ford's memoirs being, I think, 200,000 words. West Publishing Company claimed copyrights in the pagination of federal court cases, which was important because if you're a lawyer, you have to cite the page numbers in all your briefs. And so it was essentially trying to use copyright law for anti-competitive purposes. Everything born copyrighted. In 1976, when the law was revised, a critical change was made. It used to be that you had to formally register your work to get copyright protection. Henceforth, everything was born copyrighted in an envelope of property rights, so that any scribble or guitar riff you recorded on your audio tape was born copyrighted. This proved to have some remarkably difficult implications when the digital revolution and the internet arrived in the 1990s, because everything suddenly was born in this envelope of property rights, making it problematic or outright illegal to share much of the work that goes on. So you sort of have these double trends going where just as the technologies are evolving to make it easier to share and copy, you're having the proprietary expansion trying to stifle that. I tried to document some of this in my previous book, as Aaron mentioned, Brand Name Bullies. I'll just show you a few examples to give you some of the extremes to which it went. Whoops. I'll go back to... Whoops. This is Enchilada Barbie. This photographer from Los Angeles did a photo exhibit of Barbie in a variety of kitchen appliances and in sexual positions. And he only made $5,000 from the exhibit. But Mattel is notorious for chasing down the most benign uses of its work without authorization, and sued him for a variety of trademark infringements for this exhibit. The photographer, however, was one stubborn fellow and found a pro bono firm in San Francisco to represent him. And unlike most people who got the cease and desist letter, he fought it. And remarkably, it went to the Ninth Circuit, and he prevailed after his firm, San Francisco firm, spent nearly $2 million defending him. But it was the first stinging rebuke of Mattel for its over-aggressive and frivolous tactics. This is a cover of a zine that a entrepreneur produced, and it shows Matt Groening's Binky the Rabbit hitting the Trix rabbit, you know, kind of a funny illustration. But Groening, who made his career off of cultural appropriation with The Simpsons, his attorneys sued, and these covers of the zine were literally destroyed. This is a rare surviving copy that was shown in an exhibit that actually, I think, originated here with Carrie McLaren, the illegal art exhibit, which had a couple dozen different cultural works which were officially illegal and to be shown. This was one of them. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is copyrighted by his estate, and when CBS tried to show footage of it, even though it was its own footage, it intervened to prevent it, and eventually there was a settlement that was reached. But it shows how something that is seemingly part of our national heritage is actually private property. Oops, I'm going too fast again. This is a certificate giving Kembrew McLeod, who's now a law professor at University of Iowa, ownership of the phrase freedom of expression as a trademark. And he's a noted prankster. He's written a number of books on this topic, too. He's an IP, intellectual property professor. The hilarious aftermath of this is that a few years later, AT&T decided to have a marketing plan called Freedom of Expression, and Kembrew sent him a cease and desist letter and was promptly ignored because they knew that he had no legal resources to follow up on it, and that was the end of the matter, but he made his point. And these were described in my book, Brand Name Bullies. It's here, so this was the, as the internet was making copying and sharing easier, we have this vast expansion, which continues to this day, to try to lock down culture. And it's here that the viral spiral took another twist, building on the pioneering work of Richard Stallman. This, of course, is Larry Lessig. In the late 1990s, he was a professor at Harvard Law School, and he was disturbed at all of these developments. And he was also somewhat of a techie himself, and he was seeing how software code was increasingly playing the role of law, which means it was coming to regulate people's speech, how they could interact with each other, how they could interact with government, their rights as consumers, and much else. And so in 1999, at a time when many people were trying to figure out how the internet worked and what it all meant, he wrote this classic book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. It became an instant classic because it it provided a sweeping theoretical framework for explaining or thinking about freedom on the internet. Now, Lessig broke with his the people of Silicon Valley, who seemed to think that freedom naturally occurs on the internet. It was his conviction that freedom had to be actively constructed, and his famous formulation was "code is law." And he, interestingly, I didn't originally know this, he was a constitutional law professor, not a copyright scholar. So he came at it from that perspective, thinking about how code is, in a way, constitutional. For him, the big question was how to make sharing legal on the internet. How could one protect the ability of people to generate their own works and share them without copyright law and code intervening and shutting it down? So his he helped spark a lot of this. His first idea was, let's do a test case against the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. And he wanted to challenge the constitutional term that copyright is for a limited term, because it was his contention that copyright law had been extended so many times. Between 1960 and the year 2000, it had been extended 11 times, that he said it was essentially copyright was in perpetuity on the installment plan. And he argued this in the courts. Improbably, it made it beyond the federal district court level to the appeals court and then to the Supreme Court without it ever going to trial. For a trial date, because he was raising this constitutional issue. But to make a long story short, that was a little mini saga unto itself. He lost 7-2. The Supreme Court didn't really like the law, didn't speak very highly of Congress for enacting it, but didn't want to challenge Congress's authority to enact it. And so it stood. Fortunately, in the meantime, Lessig had convened a rump caucus of legal scholars to try to figure out, well, what can we do if this test case doesn't work? And their self-assigned task was to try to find a way to brand the public domain. They wanted to find a way to, but they didn't really have an idea of what they wanted to do, except they realized that certain segments of culture should be beyond that kind of strict proprietary control. Their first idea was to build the equivalent of a land trust. People would donate works into the trust that would be held, some massive website or something. But they soon realized that there were all sorts of legal and tax problems with doing that. And that's when they hit upon the idea of, well, they realized that the GPL, the General Public License for Software, was being a big success. Why not try to emulate that and develop some free public licenses for copyright holders that they could attach to their works? And the idea would be that these licenses would signal to the world that the work could be freely copied and shared, provided certain conditions were met. They devised, in the end, six basic licenses. The attribution license means you can use this license however you want, but you have to give me credit for it. Or you, the attribution non-commercial, you can use it however you want, but not you have to give me credit and no, not for commercial purposes, and so on. Then you could combine some of them. The attribution share-alike was the one that was most like the general public license because it required that anybody who used your work would have to use the same license, and therefore that content would in turn be available to anyone else down the road. Another innovation was that they devised a license. This is a deed for the license. They had three levels for the licenses. One, a human readable deed that ordinary people could understand. Then they had lawyer readable code that was the official legal license. And then they had machine readable code so that computers interacting with each other on the internet could identify those licenses. And all of those are very critical for both expanding popular understanding of the licenses, but allowing the digital infrastructure to start to integrate these licenses. So this was in late 2002, and it really proved to be a fortuitous moment because this was just when a new generation of social software was starting to take root, what we now generally refer to as Web 2.0 software. And the odd thing is, you know, why would a bunch of boring legal licenses become significant? You know, how could they possibly become the foundation for an international free culture movement? And it really is, when I first started working my book, I was mystified at how the licenses had become so significant in that respect. But part of the mystery for me was cleared up when I realized that something that was going on that I call the great value shift. And this is the explosion of highly efficient user-driven creativity on open platforms, in which essentially the network effects could just span out with enormous power. And the infrastructure was driving this. And it's become clear, of course, since then, that open platforms have huge disruptive effects on conventional business strategies and organizational behavior. And it turns out that users working on open platforms can create enormous value in their own right. And I call it socially created value can become a macroeconomic and cultural force in its own right. Historically, people who created stuff either as individuals or communities would have to work through the marketplace, or they would create it as a community and it would be appropriated or expressed only through the marketplace. But now social communities could retain that value. The licenses were important to this because they allowed that socially created value to express itself and to protect itself within the commons. And the principle essentially was that that which is created in the commons must stay in the commons or can stay in the commons based on the choice of the commoners. The consequence of this is that the commons itself could become generative. Instead of being the public domain wasteland that it had historically been regarded as, it could become generative, and there would be no tragedy of the commons the way Garrett Hardin, a famous biologist who wrote this essay in 1968, where he said that a commons would inevitably come to ruin because people would overexploit it. In the online world, you had no tragedy because, first of all, you didn't have a finite, depletable resource. You had an infinitely extensible one. And second, the more people who participated, the more in that value stayed there, the more value was created. So it was the more the merrier, as opposed to the tragedy of the common. And you see, these are some of the different arenas in which that dynamic was starting to play out. Now, a related issue was that this was starting to change the very definition of wealth, because on the internet, it wasn't just wealth, wasn't just financial wealth, nor necessarily something that was privately held. It was often socially created value that was shared, and it was evolving, and it was non-monetized often. And it sort of hovered in the air, so to speak, where it was accessible to everyone. So the great value shift is in some ways a major assault on our traditional understandings of property rights, or at least making them more problematic or less valuable because there are all sorts of other ways that value was being created. And I'm reminded of a quip by Siva Vadihayathan, who used to teach here, where he said, the only thing worse than being sampled is not being sampled. And so there was a shift in value that occurred in the Internet, which is not to say that private property on the Internet is not important or worth doing sometimes. It's just that it became a more problematic proposition for expressing value. You can see some examples of this. I'll just tell one example. But, you know, the New York Times used to have the Time Select thing, where you subscribed and got access to the archives and their op-ed columnists. But it soon realized that even though it was generating about $10 million a year and had, about 200,000 subscribers, that it made more sense to open up the platform and sell advertising. They would make more money that way by being less restrictive and less proprietary about the content, less controlling of the content. Of course, they still assert copyright on it. But the point is, on open platforms, value can be created in these different ways. Now, the first users of the CC licenses tended to be the tech sophisticates and the cultural rebels and the bloggers and the avant-garde artists. And in some ways, they were sort of the perfect group to brand a new movement. And people used the licenses less for their legal functionality, although that sometimes was important, but more as a way of social signaling to say, I affiliate myself with this other brand of creating culture, and sort of I'm thumbing my nose at big media and their ethic of proprietary control. And by using the CC licenses, leveraging the open internet and Web 2.0 software, the commoners have essentially created countless online commons and new market structures along the way, new practices in the market. One of the first users was Cory Doctorow, who some of you might know as the co-editor of Boing Boing, a very popular website. At the time, this was in late 2002, Corey was a budding sci-fi writer, and he decided to use the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license to license his first sci-fi novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And within 3 years, it had been downloaded 700,000 times for free. And the ordinary publisher would say, oh, look at all that piracy of this work. But Corey credits it with making his career as a sci-fi novelist. His book has been through 7 printings, a number of foreign translations, and a couple of audio books of his audio adaptations made by his fans. As he put it in a recent article I read, an author's problem is not piracy, but for him, obscurity. And he's found that making it free is not necessarily antithetical to also having a lucrative career as a published author. There's a lot of other examples I could mention in publishing, but let me just mention another to give you a taste of how this works. Some of you may be familiar with how Nine Inch Nails released their album Ghosts in 2008 directly. They made it for free on the internet under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. Posted audio files on the web. Please come download it. And the band didn't do any advertising or promotion, but it still sold 2,500 copies of an ultra-deluxe limited edition for $300 a piece, sold out in 3 days, and sold a regular deluxe edition for $75, and then ordinary CDs for $10. And within a week, the band had made $1.6 million from about 750,000 purchases. Now, when you consider that normally a band makes about $1.60 per CD, they made out tremendously well. And in fact, after they exhausted this line of distribution, they made a contract with the normal distribution channels and made more money through that traditional distribution. Now, in some ways, you could argue correctly that, hey, they already have a brand reputation and they're simply leveraging that, which is true. It's harder for a new band to do this. But they also demonstrated that the CC licenses allowed them to leverage the openness of the internet for visibility purposes and still made considerable money, more than they would have made through a traditional means. The Creative Commons licenses are now estimated to be on some 150 million different web objects, music, video, blogs, and so forth. And that's by the people who've made those estimates, a very conservative estimate. And the licenses have insinuated themselves into the infrastructure of lots of the internet, especially the search engines. Yahoo and Google have, you can search for content under that's shareable under the licenses. On Flickr, the photo sharing site, there's 100 million photos that are estimated to be licensed under CC content. I use the Flickr photos myself on my blog on the commons. It's a massive commons. And Flickr itself has entered into deals with the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress, to be a repository for shared photos. So the basically, the viral spiral has been unleashed by this free software and many variants of it, the CC licenses and open platforms. And it's now reaching into at least five other major areas of life. And I'd like to quickly review some of those before we open it up to a little discussion. The first is the sharing economy going global. After the CC licenses were released in December 2002, people from countries around the world came up to Larry Lessig and the Creative Commons and said, we want these licenses too, what can we do? And so within 5 months of releasing the licenses, Lessig hired a former student to open up CC International in Berlin to help oversee the porting of the licenses, meaning the adaptation of the licenses to various national legal jurisdictions, the idea to make them fully enforceable and compatible with, you know, whether you're in Finland or France or Italy or wherever, that they would be legally recognized. And that process quickly took off, and there are now 50-plus countries that use the licenses, and there's another 20 that are in the process of porting them. So it's become a very robust international movement. And just as here in the U.S., the licenses have become a focal point for a broader cultural movement, so too in all these different countries, the licenses have become a way for people both to express their affinity with this alternative mode of culture as well as for coming together. So you can get the free software people and the Wikipedians and the Creative Commons free culture people and the open access scholars and the whole set of digital tribes coming together often around the licenses. By far the most significant and the most advanced country in using free culture, using Creative Commons licenses and in promoting free culture has been Brazil. This is Gilberto Gil, the singer-songwriter. He was appointed the culture minister in Brazil by President Lula, and he became a tireless ambassador for free culture in all sorts of venues, and then internally promoting free software, the CC licenses, releasing government information and documents under the CC licenses, promoting bottom-up use of technology in villages and among poor communities and so forth. So it's been a major beachhead for free culture activity. I might add that there's been a number of Creative Commons also started a spin-off group called iCommons, expressly devoted to promoting free culture internationally. And they've had conferences in Rio de Janeiro and Dubrovnik and Sapporo. And these were sort of massive convenings of software hackers from Amsterdam and musicians from Brazil and countercultural activists from Croatia and scientists from Japan, and just this motley collection, but all of them devoted to a different vision of basically commons culture. A second viral spiral is what I consider the rise of open business models. There's a huge amount of experimentation going on right now to try to exploit the great value shift I mentioned. How can you use an open platform and less restrictive intellectual property rights to still make money, but to work in tandem with a community of people? It's a grossly under-theorized area, I think largely because it's still so experimental and it's hard to see what's going to persist and not, what's still going to remain a niche thing and what might become a prototype of a new thing. One of the biggest principles that people have discovered is, well, these are some of the major open platform owners, and they've discovered, of course, that owning an open platform can be tremendously lucrative, despite not having strict control in a traditional copyright sense. But then there's others who don't own a platform. Here's two examples: Perez Hilton, the gossip columnist, and Wonkett, who ran a Washington, D.C. blog. Both of them got discovered. Hilton got a job on the E! Channel, cable channel. The Wonkett became the Washington editor of Time magazine. There's countless examples, of course, where the internet is how you get discovered. It may not be the most reliable business model, but it has been lucrative for a good number of people and is more than aberrational. But another business strategy is to build or interact with some spirited community that exists online and to which things can be sold. And essentially, the idea is to build a market on top of a commons. And before the internet, probably the best example of this was the Grateful Dead, where they had a community of fans where they would say, you can tape our concerts and share them with each other, and we don't care. You're going to come to our concerts and buy our tickets, and you're going to buy our merchandise, and you're also going to buy our legitimate CDs. So it was a way of having a respectful relationship with the community while still making money. Well, that, you know, the Grateful Dead were pioneers without the internet even to have that, but the internet has facilitated that dynamic a great deal. One example, Star Wreck is a parody of Star Wars movie made by a Finnish producer. And he did it as this labor of love and sort of an amateur project that involved some 300 people, both professionals and amateurs. And it was, you know, done in people's living rooms. But the production qualities were pretty good. Well, they released it on the internet in 2005 with an attribution non-commercial, no derivatives license. And it quickly became the most watched film in Finnish history. And then it started percolating around the internet, and it became a big hit in China and Japan and Russia. And it became so big that they struck a deal with Universal Pictures to release the DVD of it. And the producer made a 20 to 1 return on his investment. And you could say, well, this is kind of an aberration, and in some ways it is, but increasingly you are seeing enterprising people leverage the open distribution of the internet to make money in these counterintuitive and ingenious ways. A similar example is something called Big Buck Bunny. There's a nonprofit digital animation company, nonprofit in Amsterdam that created this 10-minute short. And they use cutting-edge free software and a global community of animators to make it. And it really rivals anything that Pixar has produced in terms of digital animation quality. And in fact, they visited Pixar, and some of the animators said they really envied the creative freedom that they had to do what they wanted, because, of course, Pixar asked to make the mass audience stuff, which they may or may not have liked that much. Anyway, the Blender Institute, as it's called, released this under a CC attribution license. And they had a DVD set they sold with all the source code and all the outtakes, and so that people could remix or do whatever they wanted with the short. They sold that for 34 euros, and it's proven to be an attractive revenue model that they're building upon. They don't quite know how far it's going to scale, but it's a very promising and interesting open source, open platform business model. I might add that MIT professor Eric von Hippel has studied this phenomenon. His book, Democratizing Innovation, describes a lot of these kinds of business examples. Some of them, for example, involve extreme sports, extreme skiing, extreme skateboarding, whatever. The fans of those sports tend to be the ones who are innovating with new equipment first. And so companies, sporting companies working with those communities can help adapt, improve, and then sell those innovations. Essentially, you're using a community to do your R&D, to do your word-of-mouth advertising, and then to buy your product. So if you can have these respectful, symbiotic relationships between a commons and a market, it's a different kind of business model. A, Well, this is a bit of detail to give you an idea of how it's fantastic detail that they get through the animations. A third viral spiral is the Open Educational Resources Movement, or OER. I hate the name because it's so cumbersome to use, but it's a very robust and diversified group of projects in which scholars, students, disciplines are taking charge of their own content and collaborating to create it and then to preserve it within the commons so others can use it. The pioneer was MIT OpenCourseWare. In 2001, MIT began to put all of their course curriculum, the problem sets, the class assignments, the simulations, the exams, the video lectures, everything on the internet for free. This was at a time when the rest of the world was thinking that distance education was going to be a lucrative market, and they were oriented in that direction. MIT decided that it wasn't going to be that lucrative, and it would prefer to take whatever gains it could get through open platforms and the reputational, the way it would build its reputation. And in fact, MIT has expanded its reputation globally in science education. There are lots of developing countries, particularly in China, that emulate the MIT curriculum because of the OpenCourseWare example. And in fact, there's about 120 educational institutions around the world that now have OpenCourseWare. And there's even an OpenCourseWare consortium to help promote this style of diffusion of educational materials. There's a number of other things. I mentioned the consortium. This is the One Laptop Per Child project, which is attempting to bring inexpensive laptops to kids in developing countries around the world. Wikibooks, there's a lot of open textbook projects, especially in community colleges where textbook prices can be prohibitive for a lot of kids. They're developing their own modular, wiki-style open textbooks that don't sell for $125, but can be sold as $25 print-on-demand textbooks, and it remains something that they all collectively own. Connections is a Rice University collection of some 6,000 learning modules, which essentially people can upload a learning module, which is more than just the curriculum, but materials for teaching it, and then people can download it for free. There's 194 countries around the world that are using this, and millions of people, and it's sort of, the example I like is how there was this music teacher in Champaign, Illinois, who created wrote a music theory book, and she uploaded it to the Connection site. It's now been downloaded 7.5 million times around the world. And somebody from Connections went to some conference in Asia, and some guy from Mongolia was meeting somebody from India and says, "Oh, you use Kitty Schmidt-Smith? You know, this woman's music theory book." And so it's become a global phenomena, again, bypassing the marketplace entirely. Open access scholarly publishing is another major arena of OER developments. There's more than 4,000 open access journals out there in all sorts of different disciplines. The Public Library of Science was the pioneer in helping to give it to show that it was feasible and a reputable way to do it. Many of them are peer-reviewed, so they're as reputable in an academic sense as traditional commercial journals. But the idea is that instead of a discipline creating a work and then essentially giving the copyright and all the articles to commercial publishers who then provide some modest value added and then sell it back, often for exorbitant prices, to the university library, you can bypass that process, and through folding money into grants in the first place, the money is paid up front and then is free in perpetuity under Creative Commons licenses. These bottom three enterprises are all for-profit publishers of open access journals, which again shows that this is not necessarily free, but it is a different business model and probably less lucrative in an absolute sense as traditional academic commercial journals. Another major area of this activity is the science commons. Creative Commons created a spin-off organization based in Cambridge, Mass, called the Science Commons, which is attempting to facilitate the creation of sharing vehicles to get rid of the legal impediments, the technological incompatibilities, the social misunderstandings, the lack of bureaucratic cooperation among different players in the scientific apparatus, scientific system. It's trying to broker new solutions to all that. And the reason it's important is that every day there is so much scientific literature created that it would take one person 106 years to read it. So there's a major problem in coming to terms with this vast information overload. And the idea is you need to create new technological tools to help do that. The semantic web, for those of you who are familiar with that, is an attempt to use a new set of web protocols to allow the retrieval and organization of knowledge in more efficient pinpoint ways. I don't want to get too much into some of these Science Commons examples because they are often very complicated and still emerging. But suffice it to say, I'll just give you one example. I thought I had a slide there. There's a NeuroCommons project, which is an attempt to try to use the semantic web to amass the vast and diffuse set of video, data, journal articles, and many other digital artifacts to make them all retrievable for people who are working in neuroscience. It's sort of a test case for them to try to show that it can be done and that the scientific cycle of discovery and innovation can be accelerated if these tools are developed. They're also trying to do the same thing for physical tissue and other physical specimens that need to be shared. Right now, it's like a 19th century bureaucratic apparatus to share this. They want to try to make it more of a FedEx system so that if you want to share certain tissue samples, you can get it quickly and not have to wait weeks or months to go through this Kafkaesque bureaucracy to achieve things. A final area where there's a great deal of activity occurring, commons-based, is direct citizenship. Free culture is enabling all sorts of new types of citizen practices, and people can do things directly as citizens and they can organize their peers more effectively than ever before. And they can do this without having to work through traditional political institutions like political parties or proxies like the mainstream media. They can do it themselves. And there are many examples I could cite. Let me just name a few to give you a more precise idea of what I'm thinking about. You know, it was bloggers who helped expose some of the fallacies of the run-up to the Iraq War coverage by the mainstream news media. It was students acting in cooperation with activists who exposed the flaws in the Diebold electronic voting machines, and brought it to the attention and forced the mainstream media to pay attention to it because they were not covering it until then. It was activists and journalists and others who helped expose the abuses or the defects of the drug Zyprexa, manufactured by Eli Lilly, which was responsible for many injuries and death. And then we have the political campaigns by people like Howard Dean way, way back, but then Ron Paul and Obama, and in Connecticut, Ned Lamont, showing a sort of different kind of people-powered, bottom-up political participation. And I call this kind of thing digital citizenship, where through vehicles of their own creation, they are embodying a certain different ethic. And it constitutes a kind of shadow democratic polity in which these values are really given a greater reality than the official democratic polity. If you go online to Wikipedia, it honors these values more than, say, the U.S. Congress, which still hasn't made numerous documents available, or federal agencies that don't allow you to participate as much if you want to. The interesting thing is that these new modes of digital citizenship have emerged mostly over the past 8 years when the cultural lockdown of the Bush administration was at its most severe. In other words, this is really a hardy mode of participating. And I call this history-making citizenship. I first thought I'd call it participatory citizenship, but it's really a different ilk because you don't have to participate in somebody else's, some institutions or some policy makers or some media organization's agenda. You can do it yourself in your own voice, and you can be you can intervene more directly and make an impact. And I think that this is a really profound and catalytic and still emerging realm of transformation. I see, especially in this area, I see the commons becoming a new kind of social metabolism in our cultural ecosystem. And it's unclear how it's going to force the rest of the ecosystem to adapt, but it's clearly doing it. And I'll just read a quote that describes it a little bit better. A commons is a kind of biological entity operating in a complex cultural ecosystem. It has its own internal systems for managing its affairs, interacting with its environment, repairing itself, and defining its own persistent identity. It's a force by which ordinary people can express their deepest interests and passions directly and without institutional mediation on a global stage. This is an unprecedented capacity in communications, culture, and indeed in human history. And I think it's precisely because the viral spiral is so decentralized, so driven by personal passions of people, so socially based and highly efficient, that we're going to see many interesting new twists building upon the ones I've talked about here in the coming years. And I think that's why I'm really kind of optimistic, because I see the commons as a very potent vehicle for a lot of different kinds of institutional and societal reform that are important to pursue. So with that, let's just have a big discussion. Any questions, any comments, and let's talk for a while. Yes, sir.
Do you think that the what you call the viral nature of these GPL, general public license, is essential to promoting the type of free culture and free software as opposed to BSD license for open source?
Well, this is sort of internecine. I mean, I think that I'm myself an ecumenicist, and I understand the free culture arguments. I mean, BSD, for the most part, serves many of the same functions. And I think you get into these in-house philosophical debates, some of which may be consequential, some of which I think are less so. I think, for me, the more general point is that a community can have some sovereign control over its own creations. And if that community wants to do it under BSD, that should be their choice. But I think that the viral capacity is an important one for its propagation. Yes?
Did you say ecumenicist?
Ecumenical. I'm ecumenicist, meaning I'm ecumenical. I think you need a spectrum. You ought to entertain a spectrum of different approaches. And I guess I'm less, I don't mean this in the maybe the pejorative sense, but I'm less ideological about the right license. That said, let me note that there is a debate in some of these circles about whether certain Creative Commons licenses are adequately free, meaning the non-commercial and no derivatives license have some restrictions that you can't as freely share it. And some people object to that mightily, some people criticize the Creative Commons licenses for privileging individual choice as opposed to the more binary choice of you're either in the commons or you're out. In other words, by having so many of these choices, you start to set up sub-economies of shareable content which may not be interoperable among themselves, and this can create complications. So that's a whole other topic that really I don't really want to get into too much here, but you should be aware that there is some internal debate for both philosophical and practical reasons about the specific terms of licenses. Yes. Is that follow up?
Oh, no. It's how much do you think there is a need for restricted or non-free licensing? There are a lot of things that require a great deal of investiture that are really not sustainable without having some sort of control over the subsequent intellectual property.
Which I think is one of the reasons why the whole free culture world has never been, I think, never positioned itself as anti-business or anti-market. Because you're right, certain creating a new drug is an enormous investment, and you need a way to protect that through patents. So I don't think most of the free culture world, and certainly not I, am opposed to people having traditional licenses. It's just that this other variant of free public licenses does allow the emergence of socially created value, which is not to say that other centralized corporate created value shouldn't be protected as well. Yes?
This is, I was actually going to ask you basically the same thing.
Okay.
Which is, you know, that the share alike and free culture thing binds really nicely with the, you know, zero-cost redistribution on the internet. What doesn't really go well is when you try and make this proprietary stuff like TV shows and movies that also has just as little cost to share around on the internet. So where do you see, like, what's your position on, you know, people are anti-DRM, and DRM's still hanging out there. Like, what do you see?
Well, I mean, it seems that DRM is sort of eroding of its own weight, because the value of working on open platforms is eroding it. And the music industry has migrated away from it because they're shooting themselves in the foot by hanging on to it. So I'm not sure what your question
is. Well, just like the incentives. How do you keep the incentive for somebody to make a good TV show if they can't control whether there's going to be ads on it? You know, are you threatening something that we want to keep as a society?
Well, that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the ecology has changed. You know, one doesn't have to be a supporter of piracy to say that there's other business models out there. And it's interesting to the extent that it's helping open up new competition and democratizing cultural creation, which I think are virtues in their own right. Why should a production oligopoly in Los Angeles control most of all that?
David, maybe you could also wrap Betamax into your answer. I don't want to lose the witness too much.
Well, you mean...
This is an argument that predates digital culture by decades.
So the Betamax case in 1984 about whether the VCR to record things was an illegitimate use or not, it was upheld. You know, so legally, there's a tradition of that. And in fact, if you don't have that tradition, you've set up a situation where the incumbent business players would be able to veto any innovation. And I think that's a really dangerous precedent to get into as well. Let's go ahead.
This is a follow-up.
Okay, go ahead.
First, I wanted to mention, I think the concept of, you know, you have to pay these creators to innovate is a bit species, you know, it's like almost cultural extortion. Goes back to almost all the way to Simenides, you know, who would not write a poem unless you paid him.
Right.
It's a great poem. And the answer is, well then, don't write a poem. And he wouldn't. Case problem solved. But the previous one, I have a question, follow-up question, is do you feel that it's about restricted and proprietary licensing and the restricted and proprietary culture? And it's kind of do you draw a distinction then between those licenses and that culture enabling and being a necessary condition for that kind of innovation, or merely accelerating its growth? And the reason for this distinction is often positive, is look, it's just not going to happen without this. You know, we need this or it's not going to happen. But in reality, we often find that what they're saying is we need this or it's not going to happen now. And there's this sense of urgency, which I would personally tie into a politics of this implicit violence, which is going on behind the scenes, and this urgency is kind of invoking this violence, which is going to happen if you don't give me what I want. And so then my question is quite direct: is that culture and that licensing scheme, is that a requirement, or is that merely just speed the process?
Well, I think I would split your answer in saying I believe in philosophically in the legitimacy of certain proprietary intellectual property. Whether and how far it should go is another matter entirely, and I think it's gone grossly too far in expanding and giving exclusive monopoly rights far beyond what's necessary to induce that creativity. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but
not really, because you say, oh, you know, we can create, but the question is whether, you know, that licensing scheme is necessary for that kind of, not whether it encourages it, not whether the creator is going to go off and sulk because he didn't get enough money. The question is whether it's necessary.
There's a gross deficiency of empirical knowledge on that very question. I know that James Boyle, the Duke Law professor, has been urging the EU, which is entertaining a lot of expansions of copyright law and patent law, to do some empirical studies. And there's very little that studies that in a hardcore, rigorous way. So my suspicion is it's not necessary.
That's right.
But I think for certain genres of creation, arguably...
It doesn't mean it's not desirable, but we just need to destroy the myth that it's somehow necessary.
Yes. It's certainly overplayed as a rhetorical card. There was a question over here somewhere. Yes.
Oh. Violations and enforcement, especially...
Can you speak up?
Can you cite any examples of famous violations or enforcement of the Creative Commons license, especially in the area of commercialization and Creative Commons content?
Violations of the Creative Commons license?
And enforcement.
See, I'm drawing a blank.
There was a suit where photographers' CC licensed work was used for a TV commercial, and it was not in the U.S., it was in a European country that operates under CC, and the photographer successfully sued the advertising agency for violating.
There's been very few legal cases. There's only been three, I think, two foreign and one domestic. And the domestic one used a CC-licensed photo of some person in Texas but didn't get her publicity rights, which is a separate body of law. So CC was just dragged into that case and wasn't really germane. But the GPL has been recognized by courts. And on the same legal theory, the Creative Commons is thought to be on legally sound grounds.
No one wants to challenge it because as soon as you problematize the mechanism by which we enter into a Creative Commons licensing contract, we problematize all shrink wrap licensing, which covers a giant portion of intellectual property in this country, including you open your Windows PC and. By virtue of taking the disk out, you agree to like 90 pages of small print legal text. That goes out the window.
It was a major achievement of the people who created the CC licenses. They spent extraordinary efforts to make sure the law, if ever sued, would be upheld in court. So they fashioned it to the existing legal doctrine and case law and all sorts of mind-numbing complexities. And then made them accessible through the human readable deed of the license. You and then you.
I have a sort of a narrow question. Have you looked at the sort of what Craig Venter was doing in terms of patenting genetic sequences? Or I'm not a biochemist, so I don't know the details of what he was doing, but it seemed awfully problematic in the long run.
Well, he was trying to essentially get a monopoly over the human genome. And that's why the public institutions in the U.S., the NIH, and the Wellcome Trust in Britain were, and then lots of others, started to mobilize as a public interest competitor to release it into the public domain in advance. So once it was in the public domain, it couldn't be made proprietary. So there was a very fierce race for the future of genomic research on that. And interestingly, there was a debate about whether to release it into the public domain or to put it under a GPL-like license. And ultimately, they rejected that because to do so would imply that it could be copyrighted or should be copyrighted in the first place. So instead, they released it to the public domain. But that was...
So he doesn't have... But the current status is...
No.
None of his... All his patents are invalid.
Well, eventually the company surrendered them to the public domain because the market never materialized for it. And he moved on to another venture. So it was fascinating there. Yes?
I was hoping to ask you about Wikipedia in specific. And you seem to have looked at sort of the broad spectrum of commons-related business models and projects that try to make the commons into, if not sort of a profitable enterprise, mm-hmm. an economically sustainable one. Forward. And I mean, I find when talking to people about this that you can hold up Wikipedia as the sort of shining golden standard where we've actually made something with the commons that is better than what came before, mm-hmm. and that has,
basically taken over a market for what used to be a fairly big business.
Right.
But it often runs out of steam after that, and I find myself thinking a lot about ways in which Wikipedia may be special, and it may be its own particular phenomenon, and that the idea of sort of the Wikipedia business model, writ large, being applied to other industries and other sort of efforts, it sounds good on paper, but it's very hard to come up with good examples of where else it has worked. And I wondered if you've come across that.
Well, I think that the Wikipedia has this highly developed, highly articulated system for resolving disputes, for evolving things, and they have some serious governance problems, even now, despite their success. So I think there's still an experiment in progress, but I think the dynamics of developing scalable cooperative projects online has many manifestations, of which Wikipedia is simply one. And I think maybe the point is less that Wikipedia is a universal template than the fact that they're a very prominent workable example, just as free software is. I mean, the Commons, there's a great Commons scholar, Eleanor Ostrom, in Indiana University, who studied mostly natural resource commonses in the developing world. And she once showed me a parking spot that had been shoveled out with a chair in it. And she said, "That's a commons." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Well, in South Boston, where that was taken, if you shovel out the parking spot, you are entitled to use that for the duration of the snow, and you mark it by putting a chair in it. And it's a commons because it's a shared neighborhood understanding for allocating a scarce resource." Now, for me, it was kind of an epiphany because it said, there's no master inventory of commonses. There's no single template. There's a lot of different ways that communities can devise their own cooperative structures with varying degrees of reliance on law, technology, their own social ethics. They'll have their own idiosyncratic personalities and histories. And so the reason I tell that story is because I think that you're going to find a lot of different commonses out there that won't resemble Wikipedia, but they're generically of the family of commonses, and we're still in a emergent stage of a lot of this, trying to figure out what some of those principles are, what is the taxonomy, just like it took, you know, generations to develop market ideology, this is how markets work. And there's no single market. There's a million variants of markets. So that's how I respond to that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Sort of going back to sometimes necessary conditions we're talking about. I got confused by a lot of your examples because you included Creative Commons, you said a lot of GPL stuff, but you also included Facebook, where they really own everything you do on.
Right.
You basically mentioned some blogs on it, where tons of blogs are just moderated. OLPC, much more left of the chop, they drop their open source. I guess the question is, if this sort of copylefty licensing isn't necessary for commons, then what is?
Well,
if they are necessary, then why exclude a long history of piracy from this history of the commons when it seems like there's a lot of de facto commons out there which simply are illicit?
That's a lot. Okay. Well, I think the thing that I would most hone in on is how open platforms can be a host of proprietary platforms in which a commons is functional, but Lessig has described it as a digital sharecropping, where you're on somebody else's manor, you're doing it for their benefit based on depending upon the terms of service. However, some of those open platforms can be relatively enlightened because they understand that the business model depends upon not pissing off everybody who's there. And so there's an implied social contract. There isn't the full sovereignty and protections of a real commons, but it's commons-like. As I said, this is theoretically underdeveloped territory. But to the extent that you have cooperative behaviors that are relatively unimpeded on open platforms, albeit a commercially owned one, it may be consequential or it may not be consequential that it's corporate owned and not truly owned the way the others are. In either case, you're seeing cooperative behavior creating value, and it's a question of whether that's the commoners truly control it all or the monetization of it. So I agree there's kind of a spectrum. And I guess it's not as if I'm too priggish about that's a common and that's not. There is a spectrum, I think, that one can legitimately point to. Yes, sir.
Yeah, in this very room, a couple months back, thanks to Evan, Professor Lessig actually spoke to us here about his new remix book, and I asked a question then, which is still troubling me, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. It sounded like he was really imagining that the future way to resolve a lot of these issues was based on a distinction between the professional and the amateur work, and a lot of his thinking was hinging on that distinction, and it just seemed to me then and now, especially, like, it's a horrible time for us to be kind of trying to base anything on that kind of a distinction now. And even his example of the woman with Prince in the background, I mean, if she was making Google AdWords on the side, is she an amateur or a professional? So I don't know if you're familiar with his most recent argument. I haven't even read the book, but I just wanted to hear your
He makes the distinction for what? For legal liability purposes?
Well, as a way of kind of thinking through or modeling, like, how to devise a way through this muddle or this mess. Yeah, brokering compromise.
See, I mean, I haven't heard that, and I don't know in what precise context, but they've had a devil of a time with the CC license determining what's non-commercial and what's commercial. This is similar to that.
Yeah.
Now, I think notionally, in a general way, that's a legit, at first blush, the woman in the background of the Prince video, playing Prince in an amateur video, that's a no-brainer. I think there's many instances when it's going to be harder to tease that out, and I'm not quite sure, as a legally enforceable way, how to do that. So I may or may not part company with Larry on that, but I
might not be representing him right.
Okay.
That's what I'm gonna
okay. Yes, sir.
Richard Stallman recently spoke at the Cardozo Law School, community versus copyright, or copyright versus community.
Uh-huh.
And he suggested that essentially as the perception grows that copyright is not to the benefit of the community, there's going to be a rethink of copyright, and he suggested that copyright should be massively reduced to about 5 years. Do you think he has any traction with this?
Well, see, he's a fantastic visionary, and it's only because he had that determination and stubbornness that the GPL was able to last, to incubate and take root. That said, politically now, no, there's no traction for reducing copyright by that much. I think a strong case can be made for not giving copyright that lasts my lifetime plus 70 years. That's a gross over-incentive that prevents the stuff entering the public domain and being accessible. So,
the curve is going that way, wouldn't you say, in popular sentiment?
In popular...
You know, which this is just one
well,
symptom,
see, I think
and there could be some middle ground.
The importance of the CC license and the GPL is building a new constituency that will precisely be skeptical of copyright law in a way that you can never do by just sort of getting on a soapbox and saying, down with copyright law. I think you build a community of practice and grow it and it has practical value. The alternatives have practical value for people, and that's how you help.
But Creative Commons might become included in some new, if they redid copyright and included into a statutory thing, or there could be different levels of copyright. If you spend $100 million on something, you get one level of copyright. If you
right.
spend... You know, under 1 million on it, you get less. You know,
mere speculation how that free culture world might shake out, were that to ever get before Congress. To be fair to your point, there are people who criticize the CC licenses as promoting property discourse and individual choice as opposed to these alternatives, and you know that argument deserves to be heard. I think, in reality, a goodly bulk of the free culture world is not devoted to those property norms. So I think it's an empirical question how the free culture world will evolve, whether it's going to become more committed to copyright and broker unholy deals with Congress or set an alternative path. I mean, for me, one reason I'm a big advocate of the commons is it helps sketch out conceptually a different alternative as a vehicle of value creation. And so that's my response to trying to build a different constituency. Yes, and then I'll, over here.
Wouldn't you agree that the CC license in Paradigms is better for a case of a runaway hit or acting in the hobby, not so good for sustaining something that would be equivalent to a salary for someone who develops IP? Most of the examples that we know are for sales revenue. The example of the 9-inch nails and sales revenues are such that they're so outside the norm of other bands who release with CC.
You're saying that perhaps, but there's a lot of unknown bands that have used it as well to clearly retain their copyright control while putting it on open platforms.
So you think NBO about BCC could actually be used in areas where just like plain salaries or non-runaway hits, just generating content? Because all the examples that we see or I know of under CC that are successful or sustainable seem to either be things that people are extremely passionate about personally,
right,
or things that have become incredibly popular.
Whose salaries are you talking about? Whose salaries?
We both. What do you do? I'm a musician.
Okay. You work for a center and you're a salary musician?
Yeah.
Good for you, man.
It's a very rare group. I mean, the reality is that 19 out of 20 major label recording acts never see a royalty check. That's with the benefit of copyright. So the Creative Commons-based system couldn't really do much worse.
Well, I also think that some people have higher expectations for Creative Commons than it can possibly fulfill, because as we all know, the industry is in a shambles and new models for artists being showcased and diffusing their works haven't been developed and so forth. So a set of legal licenses is not going to remedy all of that, and it's, I think, one tool among in a much larger project, I think. I promised this fellow here.
I guess that's just the perfect question to mind, which is a lot of these questions at hand, like you mentioned, the cultural ecosystem, they're typically things that are within the disciplines, like social science questions, but a lot of the people who are thinking about it are lawyers or generalists, journalists, etc. So I guess my question is, are there any anthropologists or social scientists who are trying to look at this in a more rigorous fashion so that these stats, like, what is the percent of success rate for a restaurant or any business?
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare to any of these other models? So can you share with anyone who thinks these are interesting?
Well,
media, ecology, communication, sociology? They seem absent.
There's very few people with that kind of social science background who are doing that study. I know, I don't know if she's in the audience, Biela Coleman has been studying. But okay, Benkler has been, Yochai Benkler at Harvard has been, I don't know if he studies so much industry ecologies, but he has studied the social dynamics of this kind of commons-based peer production, he calls it. But no, I think you're pointing to a void in some of the academic exploration of it. I mean, for God's sakes, I'd love academics to do complexity theory analysis of cultural production, instead of the lawyers or the economists who are stuck in the old, So there's wide open in terms of lots of innovative.
I think there's dozens, if not hundreds, of PhDs in the works that are on these topics, though.
Well, that's great to hear. That's great to hear. Yes, sir.
You spoke a little bit about the new species of citizen and their ability to kind of self-organize.
Right.
And that was a theme of Ostrom's work, is the ability of people to rewrite the rules, to write themselves out of the tragedy of the commons.
Yeah.
But mainly that's, in the creative commons, that's in reaction to poor state control or poorly implemented. But as they get better and better at self-organizing, do you see them kind of becoming as powerful, these sort of transnational entities?
Well, you always see the rudiments of this transnational citizen cooperation. I mean, even before the internet, we had the landmines, ban landmines campaigns, and you have lots of ethnic diaspora communities from Africa or China who use the internet to cooperate and organize. But then even within the traditional tech world, we have free software, the Wikipedians, the Creative Commons licenses, transnational entities And then a lot of the cultural sectors, you know, remix, video mashups, there's lots of transnational collaboration and inspiration going on. So whether that can crystallize into a durable political form, unclear. But I think the rudiments are there, and they are starting to, because of the capacities of networked cooperation, are starting to challenge the nation state in new ways. Because they get information faster, more on-the-ground knowledge, can whip it around more, and the State Department, which is still a centralized hierarchical institution, is like caught flat-footed. So, you know, I found it fascinating that the nation's 12 or 13 intelligence agencies have an Intellipedia, because they realized that was a better way to share knowledge. So how is government going to change? How is citizen governance going to find some sort of rapprochement with the liberal state trying to push things down? I mean, I think that's a fascinating question. Yes?
I have a question about that digital governance and digital citizenship. Which do you think would be a better step towards increasing citizen participation? Opening up the code for all the programs the government uses to run it, or freeing up the data that informs all the decisions that are made, or some third option?
Both.
Well, which do you think would be the better?
I mean, the government could do a whole lot more procurement with that would allow open source or free software systems to take root. And it doesn't do that, barely talks about it at all. There are some nations like Brazil that have taken the lead in that and shown enormous cost savings. And I think, interestingly, the developing world might beat the pants off us as that culture grows and they, you know, don't get hooked on Microsoft. But in terms of your question, I mean, I don't see it as an either-or proposition. I suppose once you get the open source code going, the data would be more likely to be available, but it's kind of a theoretical question. The issue is how to move that forward.
I'm going for government, so I have to pick one.
I see. The issue is to push that ethic forward, and it would have many manifestations. Yes, and then I'll get back there.
Back on the need for more empiricism and more statistical knowledge, I certainly agree that that's something that the sort of commoners community could do more with. But it does, I think it's worth pointing out, and I'm just another lawyer thinking about this, but it's not really true that copyright itself was ever really cost-justified in the first instance. We never really sat down and accounted for, you know, what are we losing by propertizing all this stuff, and are we getting enough back from it in terms of the increased cultural production that we're looking for. And it seems to me that the shoe really ought to be on the other foot, in the sense that all of the general, all of the externalities you can see that are good, that we can make sort of, that we do make value judgments about, are on the side of the commons, and that sort of wider, more distributed access to these things is, we generally think of as universal good. And so, I mean, just as it's written in the Constitution, that copyright must serve to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, that seems to be where we need data to say that, yes, we are promoting the progress. So that's where we really fall down.
The problem is that the status quo has the upper hand, and meanwhile, the technological economic landscape has changed, and we have to affirmatively articulate the value of the public domain. You know, that's why the Creative Commons licenses were created, to allow that to be articulated, because fair use through fair use law as determined through court cases was just like a morass that didn't articulate that. So I guess I'm agreeing with you that, you know, we need to articulate that, but it's a hard political thing to do given where we've drifted.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously almost impossible politically because some of the more recent developments are so sort of completely unjustified. I mean, nobody could ever give you an explanation why it needs to be life plus 70 instead of life plus 50.
Yeah.
And I mean, and also, retroactively extending copyright terms isn't so much about we can't get Robert Frost to write another poem, but that we can't get Robert Frost to write that first poem over again. Like, we got he got the incentive he was going to get when he wrote that first one, and he's never going to write it again. And when he has life plus 70 for anything he writes tomorrow or the next day,
So it seems like we've really gone so far that it seems like we ought to be able to walk it back a little bit. I agree that the status quo is there, and we can't overthrow copyright writ large. But there are some things where, if you want to talk about cost versus benefit, we ought to be accorded some kind of presumption.
See, but that's precisely why Larry Lessig thought that he could prevail on the Copyright Term Extension Act. And my point is, even on a slam dunk case like that, he couldn't prevail in the Supreme Court. And certainly he couldn't get through Congress. And so with Congress and the courts both locked up and not wanting to do anything, what are you going to do? And that's why the private initiative, that's why he focused on the private initiative. So it's, I guess I wanted just to underscore that, you know, intellectually it's unassailable. Politically moving it is another issue.
And as you point out, the court was able to hide behind the somewhat supportable argument that who are they to reinvent that the Constitution, one sentence in Article 1, Section 8, wasn't enough to have them overturn a law that was just written by
a law that would roil major industries throughout the country, and they didn't want to take that heat. Is one interpretation.
Yeah.
We had a question.
I've got too many questions. Also, I've got too much to say. So I won't ask any questions at all except one. How many people in the audience have ever read through Microsoft EULA?
Unfortunately,
I can't really. You
when,
right?
When I installed Silverlight, I read the whole thing.
For Silverlight or for the OS?
Silverlight plugin.
Interesting.
Which is a lot smaller than Windows.
Well, I have a much longer rant, and I can't give it because it's David Bollier's talk. But I do just want to leave. I want to say one thing. The only people in the software business who take copyright seriously is the free software movement. The proprietary people, Microsoft, and the Microsoft users, people who have it running in their machines, they don't take copyright seriously. They don't read the things. Microsoft doesn't abide by its own thing. And if people took copyright seriously, or at least the claims supposed to fix the copyright, I think that would be very useful. I mean, what I was going to rant about was only free software also defends private property, namely the right to own a computer. Mm-hmm.
That's a good rant. That's a good rant. Well, time for one more question, then we need to wrap up. Yes?
Well, I was just going to say, it seems to me from what you have said that this whole, virus style open site is also challenging the whole idea of, the nation state and even, the corporate structure of all. And, how do you see this? You're talking about, all these different communities, but not, as a kind of all-encompassing, worldview, but more, breaking down, old models.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the tail end of it.
Breaking down, old models.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the market has shown over generations itself to be tremendously versatile. So I don't think there's any question that it's going to find new ways to make money on open platforms. But it is disruptive in the meantime to the incumbents. That's capitalism. So the nation state similarly will find a lot of resources to challenge some of these things. And in fact, that's why net neutrality is such an important issue, because if net neutrality is ever suspended or eroded, some of those core capacities of citizens and commoners to build out their own world will be stymied. Now, I guess it's not likely to happen in any grand transformation, Marxist style or something. It will be a coevolutionary conversation between those institutions and the insurgents. But what I am saying is I think the insurgents have a lot of capacity that's being ramped up and is likely to be transformative of those institutions in the years ahead.
Here we go.